another episode of the William Branham Historical Research Podcast. I'm your host, John Collins, the author and founder of William Branham Historical Research at william-branham.org, and with me I have my co-host and friend, Jed Hartley, son of a false prophet and former member of the International House of Prayer. Jed, I was watching television the other day, and interestingly, I have this fascination with ancient mythologies, and they're now putting out all of these anime cartoons and television shows and all kinds of different things that reference themes, and I was watching one of them of the cult of Dionysus, hoping I'm saying that correctly, but one of the mystery cults, right, with the ancient rituals, and I got to thinking about you specifically.
Okay.
Because we share a lot in common, you having come out of the IHOP KC, me out of Branhamism. You were in Branhamism 2.0. I was in Branhamism 1.0.
Right.
And if you really think about its essence, if you understand the ancient mythologies and how they work, it really was nothing more than a mystery cult. And it matched all of the patterns of a mystery cult, every single one of them. And you can study, there are a thousand studies of these. But I got to thinking of something that, the reason I was thinking of you specifically, my family was at the top of it, as was your family at the top of it. And when you're in a mystery cult, it reminds me of, I don't know, a bunch of little kids playing marbles or something, and some guy comes up and he's got the big marble, you know, the big fancy one that you can roll and hit the others, and nobody else has it. And he's like, this is mine, my secret marble. Well, that's how we were, man. We were like, you know, we felt like we were elite people because we had the secret mystery. And when you're on the inside thinking of this, you start to look down upon people on the outside. But the funny part of it is, having crossed the barrier now from the inside of the cult to the outside of the cult and talking with people, people realize this, and nobody wanted it.
Well, there's this sort of lawlessness in these communities. And so when you have the elite members of the community, those are the ones who get to set some of the laws. But there's a catch-22 with being among the, being the one with the big marble, or being the one who is able to like have be a part of this sort of elite community, is that you also got way more attention and you were way more in the thick of whatever is going on. Like, we couldn't just pass. IHOP was going to always be a main storyline for my own life. Like, there was no, it was no, never going to be a situation where it was going to rest on the side, because we were so inundated within that community that was always going to be everything that my own life was defined by. The way that I grew up was defined by my father, and not just defined by my father insofar as what he did and how he raised me, but defined by my father as insofar as my community very much defined who I was in relationship to my dad and to this sort of legacy that I was stepping into. So prophecy was a huge thing that, as even like a young kid, I remember being encouraged, not just by my dad, but by the rest of my community, to sort of follow in my father's footsteps and tell great, you know, have visions, dreams, do different prophecies. And this was, I mean, this was true for any of the young students who grew up in like the equipping center. This was the name for, I think we've talked about it before, but the Children's Equipping Center was run by a man named Lenny LaGuardia, who has had all sorts of crazy stuff written about him recently and about the things that he was doing, but that's a whole different story. But the Children's Equipping Center, when we were growing up in it, the whole idea was that equip children to do signs and wonders, to speak in tongues, to prophesy, to heal the sick and everything like that. But I think that there was this sort of special focus on me and my sisters, and other individuals like Samuel Hood or other young children who are growing up in this sort of authority and in the mantle of this sort of elitism, the elite like families of IHOP. And I mean, don't get me wrong, there was a whole lot of like benefits that came with that. Like I was able to have my voice heard in ways that other people were not able to. Even now, like even speaking to you, John, like part of the reason that my voice has been more relevant in some of these discussions is because my father was a prominent individual within that community. And people who have been involved with IHOP, there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I know Jedediah Hartley, or I know the Hartley name, and recognize some of that, like, they were around, they were prominent, they were a part of this group. So like, I don't want to dismiss that. The elitism came with like a whole lot of weight, but that weight also had everything within that world that developed, like even the beneficial things were corrupt. Like it's sort of the fruit of the tree is always going to be rotten. If the roots of the tree are rotten, then the fruit of the tree is always going to be rotten. And any positive thing that comes out of that community is only going to be good for very specific situations, or, basically it just allowed my dad to get away with a lot of things that he should have never been able to get away with. But that wasn't a good thing. Had we had been in a different position, there probably would have been a whole lot more accountability that I would have seen. So, that was a very meandering response to your first, thought, but just reminiscing about it, like the elitism that came with that community that I was growing up with had a good side and a bad side to it, for sure.
Yeah, it's hard not to think back. I've got all of these crazy stories running through my head, and I can never get them to come out before we start a podcast, but after we start talking, I remember I used to go to different churches. I've mentioned on the podcast, I went from churches from Arizona to South Carolina, everywhere in between. I lived in many of those places. Some of the churches I would go to, I like to play my guitar, and if the church would allow it, I would go up and sometimes I would sing what we called a special, and I guess in the Pentecostal circles that's how it's called. But I would play these songs, and everywhere I would go, if I was introduced, they would say, now this is Brother Collins' grandson, John Collins. I was always introduced, it was always that link, mm-hmm. because we were mm-hmm. special, right? And it got to the point, if I was introducing myself, I got to the point where I would just bypass it. I would say, I'm Brother Collins' grandson, and shake their hand. And I would never forget, I went to this youth, I don't know what it was, like just gathering in this, they'd rented a gymnasium. And I walked up to this girl, I was like 16 years old, wasn't dating yet, walked up to this girl, she was kind of cute, so introduced myself to her, and I said, I'm Brother Collins' grandson. And then it hit me, that was the stupidest thing I've ever done. And she just looked at me and laughed and said, well, hi, Brother Collins' grandson, and made me feel even lower, right? But we had this esteem because of our connection to the leadership, and in, at least in the Branham circle, is the only real claim to fame. It wasn't really because of my grandfather, it was more that my grandfather was close to the central figure. That's right. Really the connection. And it took me years after leaving to even understand that my grandfather really meant nothing. It was just that connection. It was one step closer to the quote-unquote prophet. What made me come to terms with that, ironically, is another thing that we kind of have in common. Whenever somebody goes public with all of the critical information, it's like if you're living in the olden days and you have, you know, you injure your leg too bad, well, the only hope you had was just cut your leg off. Well, that's what they do with anybody who's got like critical information. So instead of, hi, I'm Brother Collins' grandson, all of that prestige that comes with that, I could be influential to people who are in the cult with all of this knowledge that I have, you know, that just completely overturns all of Branham's ministry. But now, because I'm critical, they cut not just me, but they severed at Grandpa. Well, Willard Collins means nothing. Willard Collins was just the pastor of the Branham Tabernacle. So it's kind of reversed, which is weird. And it's all just simply because I started publishing critical information.
Yeah.
If I was publishing pro information, I would probably have a website and people would say, why don't you put your Willard Collins grandson on the top of your website?
I think that's interesting because the elitism, they're able to cut it off real quick of like who's in the in-group and who's in the out-group, who are the elite ones. And so you can, I was kind of like writing, not on purpose or intentionally, I was writing my father's coattails on, in especially actually the funny thing is more so in Bethel than in even the IHOP. I mean, my dad was a big deal in the International House of Prayer circles, but it was more mixed of, there would be a lot of people and members who didn't even know who he was. But at Bethel, and it's exactly what you were saying, because my dad was closer to Bill Johnson in the 2010s, at least. Like, my dad became a very prominent prophetic figure in Bethel's sort of inner community, and he got grafted into that inner circle and this sort of elite group, and he was sitting Bill Johnson was way more intentional about trying to elevate my dad and indicate, signify that he was one of the elites. Like, he would set seats aside that we would always, whenever we drove to Bethel, there was always like a parking spot up front that had his name on it, and all of these sort of almost even corporate, like it reminded me of going to like a law firm or something like that, where there's partners and like the partners have big offices, and then whenever a partner walks in, that's like, you can tell that this person is an important person within the firm, and everybody kind of shows reverence to that. Bethel, I think, that did that even more so than IHOP did, or at very least, my dad was able to catch and get into that sort of elite group at Bethel more prominently. But it is one of those things. It's just, you can kind of ride the coattail, but as soon as you're out of it, and this is exactly what happened with so at IHOP, as soon as scandals start coming on with Mike, and then scandals start popping up with my own dad, it was so fascinating to see how a lot of IHOP people pretended like my dad was never involved with the International House of Prayer. I mean, Mike himself was even just talking and being like, oh, I barely even know the guy. On an actual interview, so Mike Bickle is being accused of all of these things. He's kind of being mum's the word on all of this, not saying anything to reporters and being very like intentional and strategic about not releasing any information. And then an article comes out about my dad and Mike's affiliation to my dad. And that's the one time Mike makes a statement and he's like, I have no affiliation with Bob Hartley. He did his own thing and everything like that. And it's that sort of, you're in the elite group, but then as soon as you have reason to be pushed out of the elite group, then, you know, they'll do it at a drop of a hat. Now, we'll say Bethel still kept my dad within the elite group because he is one of the revered group, even after all of this. I mean, we've talked about this ad nauseum about how Bethel responded to my father's scandal, or didn't, more accurately, just didn't respond until I put like a bunch of external pressure on them. But it is this sort of thing. It's like this in-group, out-group, the boundaries of it are very fluid, and you say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing, your affiliation with the central figure could be cut off at any certain point. And so there, despite the fact that this elitism doesn't actually grant you any real benefits other than just sort of the prestige and reverence within that community, which has its own costs, like I was talking about earlier. There's still this sense of like, well, if you want to hold on to it, you have to conform to everything that everyone's doing. And for people like you and me, who are sort of in that elite group, or were, neither of us are anymore, but when we were a part of that sort of elite group when we were young, and we were sort of de facto a part of it because of our blood relatives, even more so for us, like that line was always something that I was aware of was going to change and shift. And I remember when I went to a secular school, I just went to a college. I went to UMKC. This was when I was like 24, after I had gone to YWAM and wrote the book about my dad and done all of these things. I was starting to sort of question not even Christianity, but I was starting to question whether or not this was the version of Christianity that I really believed in and whatnot. And I remember feeling like this sense of, well, how is this going to work? How am I going to be able to maintain relationships with the people within my community? Because I can't have one foot in, one foot out. I can't come and pretend like I'm a part of it. Now, I did for a lot of times. And actually, as long as I was keeping the masquerade up, it was actually kind of fine. But that was that sort of pressure and tension of like, well, if I don't follow in my dad's footsteps, if I say that I don't believe in prophecy, I mean, I could be a cessationalist and be like, oh, the gifts of spirit ended this. I'm still a Christian. I'm still a devout, you know, believe 90% of the doctrines that are supposed to be important to this world. But if I rejected some really big premise like this, I would suddenly be ousted from that sort of inner group, and in doing so, ousted from the group entirely. And I remember feeling that sort of tension and pressure to conform to this sort of character that only this elite, if you're in this elite group, you have to conform to this certain caricature. And if I didn't, then I'd be out.
Well, see, there's where your story and my story differ quite a bit. Because where you didn't really get any benefits, man, I got one of the greatest benefits of all. I got the get out of jail free card.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
So in the Branham cult, if you were an elite person, like my grandfather was, and there were others that I've talked to who have now escaped that are in the same category as me, Branham would, well, take a step back. Picture the marble game, the people come, the kids are playing, the kid comes with the secret marble, right? Well, now he says, okay, you, and you, I'm going to let you play with my marble, but you others, you can't play. You have to watch. Branham did this. He would go to specific individuals who were the elites, and he would say, all of your children and your grandchildren will be saved. And you have this blanket free ticket to heaven, man. I was under that blessing. So I can do anything I want. I can do this podcast, and I'm still saved. Mm. What's interesting is the people who are condemning me, they don't know that I have this free ticket to heaven. And you're going to hell, John. You're talking against the prophet. But I had this, and it's all part of that elite mentality. You're literally looking to the central figure for your salvation. And because it's a pyramid scheme, the central figure's at the top. Well, in the middle tier, which is where our families were, you had these elites that were just a little bit above and better than the rest of the group, the rank and file members. And the access to the central figure for the rank and file members was through the middle tier. So that's why it's built like this, right? Dr. Stephen Hassan's book really spells that out really well. It's Combating Cult Mind Control, if you haven't read it. But that pyramid of authoritarian control, it's really interesting, and it explains everything that I'm talking about here. When you're in the middle tier and you are the access to the central figure, everybody's going to be nice to you. The moment you come out of this, the moment you have critical information, you're suddenly, they have no need for you. It was much like, what's a good example? The Prohibition. During Prohibition, all of the gangsters were like these special, worshipped, venerated figures, right? They're getting everybody the alcohol that nobody can get. And they're like Tom Cruise of their day, driving fancy cars, dressed in the suits. Everybody just loves them. Until suddenly, alcohol is no longer illegal. Anybody can go buy it. Nobody cares about these guys, right? Because they don't need them anymore. Well, you and I, that's another thing we do share. They don't need us anymore. And so, like for me, I don't know how it was for you, but for me, almost every one of my friends cut me off. They could just care less if I go off to hell and in a handbasket, because I'm no longer in that chain of command, that authoritarian command.
And when you're saying like the carte blanche thing that was given to your family of like everyone within this, no matter what you do, you are still God's, you know, chosen, because Branham anointed your, I guess, grandfather and his descendants. I was thinking about it because I was like, well, I wonder what the difference is, because I didn't feel that sort of sense of like anything that I do. And I think what you were talking about is my access to the cult and to Mike Bickle and to later Bethel and these elite members of the community was like entirely through my dad and not through sort of like the Hartley family legacy. Like I think that we weren't in it enough to actually be independently a part of this sort of elite group as a family. It was very much through my dad, who was a prophet. Well, and to some extent my mom earlier, but I don't think that carried as much weight. I mean, it was definitely through my dad's authority. And so the analogy that I was saying, or the thing that I was saying earlier about how if I had been a Christian and I started pastor a church and I just chose a denomination that was different, that didn't really embrace prophecy. Well, the reason why I've picked that as an example is because my dad was a prophetic figure. And so if I did anything that denied or lessened the authority of my father, then I was cutting off my own access, because that was the only way through it. And turned out my father was abusive and was had all sorts of really big issues, and like my relationship with him frankly about an abusive relationship in which he would lord things over me. He would manipulate me even well into my 20s. And so my own access and authority to this community was through the very figure who was sort of being abusive to me. And so, and this sort of worked to reaffirm my dad's authority in our family. And he absolutely used it as best as he could, where, I mean, my sisters and I and my mom and everyone, like when my parents separated, my mom had to leave the community. Like she was not a part of that world anymore. And she at the time hadn't really gone through a deep crisis of faith of like, I mean, it really was just about like her relationship to my father. Later, I think that she then asked a lot of questions about the version of Christianity that she had sort of come to embrace. But I mean, she could have stayed well within that community, but it became very clear that this sort of like questioning your access into this upper echelon of the community was going to lead to you being ostracized from the community. And On the other end, there were very few things that my father could do that could get him kicked out of it. I mean, eventually, once it became Mike Bickle and Mike Bickle realized that he was going to get in trouble by association with my dad, that's when he cuts it off really quickly. But I mean, there were so many different things that were happening that my father was doing. I mean, whether actual illegal activities that we have talked about too, and really abusive activities, but even more just crazy, insane, and just bizarre behaviors that he would do, where I used to joke with him. Well, I didn't even joke with him. Like I told him, I would always be like, man, you must have some angel who follows you around all the time, because the favor that he had where he could just get away with everything that he ever did, whether there's so many times where I was like, man, you should be in all sorts of trouble, whether with the law, whether with the community, whether with just Mike Bickle himself or Bob, Bill Johnson. Like there was times where my dad was clearly caught lying about his prophecy, and it was just these instances where I was like, I cannot believe that you can get away with these things, and yet he did. And I was like, well, you must have some angel looking after you. And then later I sort of started realizing, oh, well, this is the function of the cult. This is part of the structure of the cult community, is that when you are a part of that upper echelon, as long as you don't question the authority of the person above you, as long as you don't disrupt the apple cart, it doesn't really matter what you're doing. It doesn't matter if you're following the rules. You still are grafted within that community, and you can kind of do no wrong, and you have this sort of eternal favor upon you. I think I've told you about this before, but during fast, my dad would we would have like the solemn assembly fasts, and it was a very famous thing that IHOP would do. When the first solemn assembly happened before I was born, but there would be these sort of community-wide fasts, and my dad, as a sort of leader of the community, would talk about how he was fasting too, but I would see him behind the scenes, and that man was not fasting. There was that, like, he wasn't. He even would joke about it. He would take, sometimes they were doing like liquid fasts where like you can't eat anything solid, you can only do liquids. And he went to McDonald's and he got a burger, and then he put it in a blender so that he could drink the burger, which was disgusting. And I don't actually think that he drank it. I think he just then got another burger and ate the actual burger. But he had no self-restraint, so there's no way he was going to actually not eat food for 21 days or whatever it was. But he would go and he would talk like he was doing that, and it was very clear that he wasn't doing these things that he was saying that he was doing. But it just didn't matter, because it wasn't the point of it. It doesn't matter whether he's telling the truth or he's fulfilling these things. He is helping build out the persona of the cult. He's helping build out the legacy of this sort of cult community. So as long as it is helping Mike Bickle gain aura and authority, as long as it's helping Bill Johnson gain aura and authority, then it doesn't really matter whether he's telling the truth. And that goes back to, well, how is this prophet figure who was just stealing directories and looking up information on Facebook, how does he become a upper echelon member of this community? It's because no one cares whether or not it's true. They just care whether or not it's going to help progress the agenda of the cult.
Have you ever wondered how the Pentecostal movement started, or how the progression of modern Pentecostalism transitioned through the Latter Rain, Charismatic, and other fringe movements into the New Apostolic Reformation? You can learn this and more on William Branham Historical Research's website, william-branham.org. On the books page of the website, you can find the compiled research of John Collins, Charles Paisley, Stephen Montgomery, John McKinnon, and others, with links to the paper, audio, and digital versions of each book. You can also find resources and documentation on various people and topics related to those movements. If you want to contribute to the cause, you can support the podcast by clicking the Contribute button at the top. And as always, be sure to like and subscribe to the audio or video version that you're listening to or watching. On behalf of William Branham Historical Research, we want to thank you for your support. You know, I was sitting there trying to remember during the introduction of this, I was using the example of the kid with the marbles, and I was trying to remember, there was a specific movie or television show where it was the same kind of situation. I don't know if it was marbles or not, but as you were talking, it made me think of something else that is just so funny when you really take a step back and look from the outside in on all of this. How many different episodes of the Little Rascals television show this resembles, man.
Yeah.
I remember this, I think this was Little Rascals. Somebody will correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was Spanky, if I'm remembering correctly, came to school with this toad, and he was showing it, and he had the secret, man. He had the secret toad. So everybody's coming up, and they're looking at this, and then eventually they started selling tickets to come see the toad, right? So you've got Alfalfa, I think it was, who's there getting the tickets. I can't remember how it was all playing out, but you look at this movement, and that's really what it is. You got the guy with the secret toad, and then they start selling tickets to it, and now you can give your tithes, offering your sell your children, and get access to this information. But it's, and I'm trying to remember another example from the Little Rascals, I'm drawing a blank, but there's also this thing where if you as the central figure have the secret, and everybody's trying to get access to the secret, you're going through that middle tier to get to it. Well, that middle tier suddenly feels important because they are relaying the information of the secret. And then what happens as it relates to the secret mythologies, the mystery cults, what happens is as they're relaying this, they get their own idea of what that secret means. Oh, this is the spiritual toad, or, you know, I had a dream about the toad. Mm-hmm. We actually, there was this guy, crazy stories. There was this guy who was convinced, because William Branham told him, convinced that he needed to buy this multi-million-dollar airplane, that when William Branham rose from the dead, he would be flying around in this airplane and then hold this one last big revival. They would just fly the tent from town to town. And, you know, William Branham's dead in the casket. There's no way he's coming up out. But this guy starts relaying the story to all of the people, especially in my sect of the cult. And they're thinking, oh, wow, this is great. When is this going to happen? I grew up, of all the stupid things that I believed, I grew up thinking that this weird thing was going to happen. Well, eventually what happened is he started having dreams, because he's talking about it so much, he's starting to have dreams about what all of this means, and somehow he gets it pieced together that it means that heaven is going to be this great big pyramid, and everybody's going to have their little rooms, and the mansions that it talks about in the Bible are actually little rooms in the pyramid, and Jesus is at the very top, and we're going to go live in this pyramid. And I remember as a kid thinking, I don't want to live in a pyramid. I want a big house with a big open field. I want my mansion to look like a mansion, not like an Egyptian. What is this weirdness? But the point I'm trying to make is there are things that enter the mythologies of the cults, and people will accept that because this guy was one step close to William Branham. Branham told him to do this thing, and he has this special inside knowledge. Will people believe that knowledge? And then anything that he says with it, they will believe until he gets discredited. So now he has this special claim to fame. His dream enters into a mythology, and there's several examples of these kind of dreams. Well, what happens is that turns into a new mythology, and the original mythology has changed and shifted. And look at the ancients, like ancient Egypt. You look at the different versions of what they believe, their mythologies, their mythology stories. It changes and shifts over time through the centuries. And that's the very reason, because somebody has this spiritual revelation of what this means. Now let's turn and shift the mythology towards that. And in the end, if you really take a step back and look at all of this from the beginning to the end. The reason why we have a Branhamism 2.0 is because of exactly this. It has shifted and morphed, and it actually changed from Branham's going to raise from the dead and he's going to take us and give us our new bodies to we're going to have this big, massive event in Kansas City, and this is where the army is going to be formed. I mean, you think of how much and drastically that has changed. Well, this is the reason why it has changed.
And you can see that evolution in the from Branhamism to IHOP, or even IHOP in the 90s to IHOP now, and this sort of like who gets to add to the myth and who gets what myths stick and what ones don't. Because you're absolutely right. And this is how it would work is people would be able to contribute their own sort of dreams and visions, and some of them would stick and some of them wouldn't. Sometimes you would have the Bob Jones like figures who give crazy dreams where it becomes sort of ordained and grafted into the legacy of the whole community and says, okay, this is part of it. And sometimes you would just have people who gave the weirdest prophecies and everyone just kind of looked the other way and they disappeared and it didn't matter. And it was this sort of it's sort of nebulous because in some senses it wasn't just Mike Bickle, but it was this sort of unspoken network of the elite groups at IHOP kind of decided which ones they were going to latch onto or not. I mean, Mike Bickle had the authority to ordain any prophecy or any sort of message if he wanted to. But that's how you also have these behind the scenes prophecies that Mike Bickle was doing about his wife dying in an earthquake and that he was using to groom young women into relationships with him that he was grooming these young women for. It's because there's this sort of weird, nebulous, boundaryless way for those who are within the elite community to sort of say whatever they want and build out whatever narrative they want. And then the cult kind of progresses by morphing around these different things. Like we've talked many times about how your like stringed instruments were not a part of, they were forbidden by the cult until it sort of, it's not still like within the message. Is stringed instruments still banned?
In the sect that my grandfather managed until his death, it was. And I think as the Branham Tabernacle split, and so I think one group doesn't and one group does, it's kind of weird. And that split kind of goes throughout the world when you think of it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Well, and that makes sense because it's those weird ones that people sort of gain a conviction for in the moment. Does it last 10 years? Does it last 20 years? But there's two things that I was thinking of when you were talking too. There was a program that IHOP ran called Master's Commission. That I don't know if you've heard about this, John, but Master's Commission was a program for young adults in their sort of late teens, early 20s to come and sort of intern at the International House of Prayer. And this is where you got a lot of the early musicians and harp and bowl prayer intercessors. You had a lot of the young fuel behind the fire of the International House of Prayer. It was before it was like an internship, but it was this sort of weird program, or maybe they did call it an internship then. But you had these what we called MCs, and they would come in and they had very strict rules on what they could do and what they could not do. And if they showed up late or if there was all of these different ways that they could get consequences. They could have what it was called. They called it Monday Club. And it was different chores that they were given. If you didn't show up on time, if you were late, or if you, I don't know. I think there probably were very some horror stories about who was getting punished for what reason. Like one of the rules was that women could wear shirts that had letters on their chest because they didn't want people that was seen as impure, because you're drawing attention to your chest if you have letters on your shirt, because that's, you know, across the chest, and you're having men's eyes be brought to your chest. And so there was different rules, especially for women, that they could kind of get in trouble for, and not all of them were clear and not all of them made sense, and they sort of were at the whims of these elite individuals. But what would happen is that these Monday clubs, they had to go work for people. And one person that they had to work for a ton was my dad. So this was a big part of my, I remember my childhood in the 90s and early aughts, there would be tons of individuals who would come into our house, and they would reorganize our house. They would do cleaning. They would, my dad had an office in the basement where he had all of these tapes that were from different meetings with Bob Jones, and all of these different tape cassettes of every sermon Mike Bickle ever recorded. And he would have these MCs go through and organize, and they would go through and they would write down everything about each one of these tapes and all the details of it. And they would have to listen through this, which is, I mean, a real system of indoctrination, is forcing students to listen back through old sermons and whatnot. But also my dad had a cleaning company, and he would use their labor for the cleaning company. I was going to say it was only young men, but actually I think there were young women too who would come, and they would have to work cleaning movie theaters. Of course, this was unpaid labor that they were doing. So as far as like reaping the benefits of the elitism, I don't know about me as much, but my dad was getting all sorts of benefits because he was literally getting these unpaid labor interns coming, helping organize our house, helping him do whatever he wanted because he was part of that group. And this was a good way to discipline individuals. And they got disciplined a ton. I mean, there was every single Monday, there was one or two people who were coming and helping my dad with some task, whatever task he wanted them to do. And he was often harassing many of the individuals, if not sexually, but physically. Like he would wrestle them down and sort of intimidate them. He thought it was fun, but of course I heard many horror stories later of people being super intimidated and victims of sort of my dad's aggression, because they were just kids and they had already been punished for something that oftentimes was outside of their control or was not, you know, anything that they ever should have been punished for. But yeah, this was the sort of system that IHOP was running.
It's common too. I've seen in many of the different branches of the cult movement, there are many people who offer free services, and you know, it's not like it's required, but there's this feeling whenever you're working with this tier system of authoritarian control, and your access to the central figure is through the people who are close to them. Well, your access to information is through them too, so you want to be around them more. And I think that's really the bottom line. It's not that it was required in the Branham cult, but when I left, I was like, man, there was a whole bunch of free stuff that I got that I no longer get. Everything from car maintenance to who knows what all else. What's funny is after we left, I had a guy that was working on my hot water heater, and I just literally called some guy out of the phone book. I didn't know this guy from Adam. And then when he showed up to my house, oh, you're Brother Colin's grandson. And man, I wanted to do it. I just felt guilty. I want to say, yes, I am, brother. How are you? Because I would get a free labor. And yeah, the funny part is I think he actually offered it, and I refused to let him do it for free. I wanted to pay, you know, because I wanted to be on the up and up. But that's how it is when you're like this. And it isn't that I'm anything special, but I'm that in that chain that is linking to the central figure. The irony is our central figure was dead, so they couldn't really access him, but they could access just the glimmer of hope that they might hear something about the central figure that they couldn't hear from elsewhere. And because of my relationship to my grandfather, that's really all that it was. But you're being taught, you're in a system that is teaching you literally that you are the purified elite, and people want to know how to be more purified, and so they'll try to get access to information like this. And in the end, what it is, it's a carrot on the string religion. They're telling you that you're part of the purified elite, be like me, we're going to conquer mountains, we're going to become more like Jesus. Well, then people go out and live their daily lives, and they realize that, wait a minute, I'm just an average person. I know I'm supposed to feel elite, but I don't feel elite. I want to know more. What does it mean to feel elite? So they want to get around people who are closer to the central figure to get access to information so that they can feel more special. Because in the end, after you go to church on Sunday, whenever you go back to the workplace, you don't really feel that special. You just feel like, I'm an average worker in an average world. In fact, I have a chain of command of bosses that are much higher than me in most cases. So I can't feel special in this world. This world is not my home. I want to be part of that other world. And so you start to even distance yourself from reality in that way. So over time, what happens is you try to abandon the reality that exists in your life to get into the reality that you're hoping exists, but you can't really break past that barrier because you're not close to the central figure.
Well, and that's the whole shtick of the entire cult, is getting close to supernatural. Joel's army, like having signs and wonders. I mean, this is the whole thing about being able to prophesy and to be able to do miracles and to be able to heal people. That's the carrot on the stick of the entire community. But I think that this sort of the way that elitism works within the community is structured in a similar way of like, you want to feel special. It's just that's what the entire, that's how people like Mike Bickle and Bill Johnson are able to gain so much control and Branham, because there's this allure of being magical and being ordained by having been revered and being a part of this sort of close to, if I could only touch the hem of his garment sort of thing, that if I could be within this like special elite group, that suddenly this has spiritual and natural significance. And the truth is that there was, if you get within that elite community, there are benefits to it. Like there wasn't the prophecy, there wasn't the if you get close to Branham, you suddenly aren't healed of your cancer. That is the allure. That's what people want to believe. That's if you get close to my dad, you're not suddenly going to get prophecies about the rest of your life. But I saw many people who thought, well, if I just go to this Bob Hartley meeting, or if I just get closer to his son, like I now look back on it, but there were, and have much more clarity, but I had so many 20, 30 something men try to take me on as like they would mentor me, or they would get closer to me. And now I look back and see that they were just trying to get close to my dad through me, not necessarily in a super sinister way, but they probably were like, well, I want to be close to Bob Hartley, and so I can befriend Jed, and I can come sort of through this process. And I remember several individuals asking me to ask my dad to pray for them or to prophesy over them. And it wasn't not true. There was some truth to the fact that like they would maybe get more Bob Hartley prophecies, but I know that that doesn't mean that they were accurate or anything like that. But it's this allure of like, the closer I can get to this elite group, the more I will become elite myself, the more I will become special, the more I will become this supernatural person. And it's really funny that you like, you use the phrase a normal guy. Like, people realize that they are just a normal person after this, or they have to go back to their job and realize that they don't have this sort of spiritual authority, or they don't, what is granted by the elite within this cult community is not recognized by the rest of society. And there's this discrepancy between real life and sort of cult life. And at that point, people can either shift in two different ways. Either they can go back to the cult community where they think that they can get more of this, like, and reject the world, quit their job and go full head first into the cult community so that they can get a taste of this supernatural bit. Or they realize that it is all a gimmick and it's not real, and they recognize this sort of depressing reality that there isn't this ordained, there isn't an angel that is following around my dad that is going to also follow me around. Like, that isn't the nature of the world that I live in. And I say this other side because this is very much the journey that I've gone on through my life. Like, much of my 20s and early 30s was this sense of being like, coming to terms with being a person, being a normal person, not being some prophet figure, not being some Joel's Army generation child who is going to come and change the world by prophecies, dreams, and visions. I mean, a lot of my life has been this sense of like having to redefine my own identity and redefine what makes me proud of my own self. Like, I'm a teacher now, and I just finished my first semester teaching full time at a school, and finding satisfaction just doing a job well is something that I have to retrain myself to do, because I grew up where the mundane, the everyday victories of life didn't matter. Who cares if you're a good teacher? Who cares if you do this thing? It's like, we're talking about the end of times. We're talking about Jesus splitting the sky and riding on a white horse to bring back and install a 1,000-year kingdom, and so that we might have pyramids or houses that we will live in, where we will sit right next to the right hand of God, right behind Mike Bickle and Bob Hartley and whatnot. And so my entire worldview was sort of, I mean, it's sort of similar to being a recovering drug addict, where you have to, like, it rewires your brain. If you are addicted to heroin or something like that, like, it destroys the pleasure sensors of your brain so that it's harder to enjoy the rest of life, because you have only accessed this sort of bliss and pleasure through drug stimulated experiences. And I think that that's very similar to the way that the cult works, is that this was sort of the only access through this elite group and through this crazy mythology was how I accessed a lot of the like joys and bliss that I experienced as a child, truly believing that people were getting healed, truly believing that dreams were being given to me and that God was going to come back. And it was just a matter of time before the end of the world happened, which I was deathly excited for, because I thought that I was going to be something special and significant in this cosmic end of the world reality. And then to shift and be like, I'm just a teacher. I'm a good teacher, and my students will be happy having me, and I'm going to improve these children's lives by helping them get better at math. That's it. And that's fine. And that's like, I think that the more that I'm growing up and maturing in my own identity is becoming actually realizing that there is something very beautiful to that, and finding the sort of like beauty in what I used to consider the mundane and the just everyday life, and learning how to be a good person and to have an impact on the world, not through these cosmic prophecies, but rather through my everyday interaction with people around me, by being a good brother, by being a good partner, by being a good teacher, or whatever it is. This is the way that I impact the world. This is the legacy that I'm leaving on this planet, and occasionally talking to my friend John on podcasts as well. This is all, you know, part of my identity. And I think that this is something that I have had to do, and not just me, and not just individuals who grew up within the sort of elite section of these cult communities, but really everyone, because our pleasure centers and our dreams and our aspirations were all warped around a fundamental lie. And to reset and recenter ourselves takes decades of work. And that's why I think that a lot of people who realize in their later years that it was all a farce, I mean, it's a little too late. When you're in your 50s and you've already spent decades of your life dedicated to it, you're not going to spend a decade rewiring your brain because it's too late. And that's why I think a lot of the young adults who are seeing it earlier, that's where you see some of the people and some of the reaction to it. Like specifically at IHOP, there's a lot of young individuals, not just me, but people in their 30s and 20s who were in it in their teens, and they still have a lot of life to live and have some reworking and rewiring of their brain that they're in the midst of doing already. And there's this sort of like embrace of like, oh, it was a cult. Like, I think that people who are in their 20s, 30s are more likely to recognize that IHOP was a cult than people who are inundated in it for so long, because it just takes so much effort and time and rewiring to be able to step out of that world.
It does. I'm probably going to unpack this more with Jenny when we're talking about youth with a mission, but when you're in that high demand type environment, there's this inward shame for feeling like you're not keeping up. And if your body reaches its limit, you start to feel this guilt because my body is being pushed to the limits. Well, eventually burnout gets masked as you're lacking devotion in the right group. And there's this, you start to form this chronic insecurity that you're not good enough to make it. And again, that puts you and I in this weird category, because the rank and file members who are feeling that burnout, they can't make it, well, they're coming to the middle tier saying, well, what can we do? What secrets do you have? How did you do it? How did you get to be that close to the leader? And for me, like, I was just born into this, man. I've got no claim to fame. But that's really what it is. People feel this, and they feel like inadequate. And then after you leave, it gets exponentially worse, because now you've got the fears of gloom and doom that they have indoctrinated you with, on top of chronic insecurity, on top of the burnout that you had. And your life, people, when they leave, sometimes their life just turns into this real mess. And then the cult members are scolding them. See, they left and their life turned into a mess. And they don't realize that they're the one that actually caused the mess. They're just people who are escaping. So a lot to unpack there. I'm probably going to go deeper with that in one of the other podcasts. But thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that isn't, yeah, I would love to, because I think YWAM suffers from all of these same things too. So I think I will be tuning into that episode as well.
Awesome. Well, if you've enjoyed our show and you want more information, you can check us out on the web. You can find us at william-branham.org. For more about the dark side of the New Apostolic Reformation, you can read Weaponized Religion, From Christian Identity to the NAR, available on Amazon, Kindle, and Audible.